Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 18th of January, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, is Mike Robinson. And we're pleased to say we are joined today by Mark Anderson, American Free Press, also Truthhound, and David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. And we're going to be having a close look at what is really happening to Britain's defence under Theresa May and the Conservatives. Speaking of the lady, of the trousers, of course.
Yes, well, Boris got his oar in here. He's saying that countries are queuing up to sign trade deals with the UK now that it's leaving the EU, he says. He was writing in the Telegraph here, and the headline for anybody who wants to find it is Theresa May's speech showed the world how we can leave the EU and yet not leave Europe.
They're playing very, very carefully with the words, Mike, aren't they? It's fantastic. It is real craftsmanship that we're seeing here. Royal
absolutely.
Society of the Dark Arts craftsmanship.
So in this article in the Telegraph, Boris said, we will no longer be part of the common commercial policy. We're bound by the common external tariff and will no longer have our trade policy run by the EU Commission. That means, crucially, that we'll be able to do new free trade deals with countries around the world. They're already queuing up under EU rules. We are not formally allowed to negotiate these new treaties until we leave, but there's nothing to say that the ideas cannot be penciled in. And then with regard to migration, he said, we're not slamming the doors to migrants or hauling up the drawbridge because, in fact, nothing has changed. And this is becoming increasingly apparent, which means we're starting to see headlines like this in The Guardian. Regrets. I found very few polls show Remainers are getting over it. And she's saying, you know, basically that they are paying attention to, they're actually running surveys now with The Guardian to follow how people are coping with the situation. But anyway, the key point here is that the mainstream media is pushing forward the notion, Brian, that everybody, people that want to leave are really happy with Theresa May's speech, and the people that don't want to leave, well, they're still pretty unhappy, but you know,
but not so unhappy.
Not so unhappy as they were. But anyway, we published this article earlier on yesterday. This is Theresa, yes, the spider there, the Black Widow spider, and she's embracing the world. And there's a number of points in here. One of the key points is the fact that it's, you can't just take what she says and listen to the speech and that's it. You've got to actually read the transcript as well, because there are hints in the transcript. Basically, for example, she mentioned a plan for Britain. But when you look at the transcript, you find that the word plan and the word Britain have capital B's. Britain you would expect, but plan you wouldn't. So, in fact, that is a proper noun. It's a brand name, effectively. So what is the plan? Well, perhaps she's outlined a little bit of it, but she's branded it. And one of the other things, one of the other things that she branded in her speech was the idea of a modern industrial strategy, which she didn't really go into very much detail about. And the question is, what is it about? Well, she told us more about that back in November. It's an extra £2 billion government investment per year for research and development by the end of this parliament. So that's by 2020. And this new industrial, modern industrial strategy will go hand in hand with an industrial strategy challenge fund. And that's going to help Britain capitalise on its strengths in cutting edge research like AI and biotechnology. This is where we're going, AI. We're replacing jobs with robots, perhaps. This is the fourth industrial revolution that she's talking about. Part and parcel of the change in relationship between individuals and the state, something we've been talking about a lot recently, because this headline from CBS in the States gives us a clue as to what's going on, because part and parcel with robots taking human jobs is the so-called free money for all, the basic income, which is being trialled in Scotland and in a number of other places. And of course, with the basic income will come basic obligations to the state.
Yeah, it will be owned and controlled by the state. You get the basic income, you'll be in you're being a housing association, housing where there's a whole load of rules. If you don't follow the rules, you get thrown out of your house. And if you're thrown out onto the streets, there will be nothing for you, is basically what I see.
That's basically it.
Perhaps we could ask Mark. Mark, you've heard a little bit about that. What is the picture that you're getting in the US about Brexit? Maybe there's nothing because everybody is trumped up at the moment.
That's exactly right. I'm in Washington right now. The Trump inauguration is dead ahead, coming up soon here on Friday. I'm covering Congress in the meantime. Brexit is only mentioned in the context that it's seen as a populist movement and that Trump is seen as a populist president, along with the prospects of Marie Le Pen in France and things like that. So it's seen in the populist context, but it is not a dominant topic at this time. The Trump thing is north, south, east, east, and west right now. It's really the whole town is abuzz about it. Lots of protests equating him with fascism from the left, saying that he's a new Hitler, you might say. I even saw protesters with a poster that had a KKK white hood on an image of Donald Trump with the Hitler mustache. So that's what we're getting from the left, while the neocon right doesn't think he's quite militant and warlike enough. And so it's rather dividing in that sense, but it's a very interesting dynamic, and Brexit just isn't a big topic at this time.
Well, thank you for that. Isn't it interesting that you're getting this portrayal of Trump with the Ku Klux Klan outfit and the Hitler moustache? And we have a lady called Theresa May. She spoke to the nation. She put on her biggest pearls. And her best Middle England dress, because she's to be trusted. And yet this woman has built one of the biggest, most comprehensive, most vicious state spying systems the Western world has ever seen. She comes across as that nice lady, but in fact, maybe she would be better off dressed up in one of these more outrageous outfits.
Right. Look, Mark, here's one of the key things that I mentioned in the article that I posted yesterday on this, because obviously TTIP is dead in the water. TPP are dead in the water. Now, I've suggested that Theresa is like a black widow spider, and we know what happens when you get into bed with a black widow spider. It eats you. And that's what Britain is going to do, because part and parcel of what was said yesterday was global Britain with another capital G, global Britain. This is the new free trade drive, which is coming out of the British government. And with TPP and TTIP dead, what they're doing, if we take TTIP as an example, is instead of having an Uber trade deal between an Uber power block, which is the EU and the United States, Britain is acting as a kind of go-between here. So Britain and the EU will have a free trade deal. Britain and the United States will have a free trade deal. We'll end up with exactly what we would have ended up with TTIP, including the corporate governance issues. But because these are smaller trade deals, and Britain saying, well, we're taking a global view now and we're going to have trade deals with countries right around the world, because these are smaller bites of the cherry, I think they're hoping that people won't notice quite so much exactly what's being put in place here. But this is going to turn into a network of smaller trade deals rather than three or four big ones. It's a pretty big policy agenda at work.
Yeah, we can discuss this a bit more when Mark covers Trump later on in the news, I
yes.
think.
Okay, well, let's move on then to the other thing that was really only glanced at yesterday when she was making her speech. Britain's armed forces, David, are a crucial part of European collective defence. Discuss.
Yeah, well, we're seeing the wording, aren't we, as we're going along. And it started off as the first snippet we got was enhanced defence union with Germany that Fallon announced immediately after Brexit. And then it's gone from that to integrated. They called it integrated, and now they're calling it collective. But let me assure everyone actually what this is. Whatever they call it, they can call it a new word next week if they like. It's actually EU military union. It's full on, absolute, total and utter control, capital budgets, procurement budgets, operational budgets from Brussels, with a single point budget set in Brussels. So they will have control of policy and take control of our armed services. It's not a collective. That is one thing it is not. And you can follow the policy, follow the money here with this, because Fallon and May are increasing their money to the EU Defence Agency.
via the EU Investment Bank, where all the money is derived from, and all the other Whitehall machinery attains its money from similar streams. So all of the gearing in Whitehall is pro this. You're not going to get an independent voice, only other than here or UKC or Veterans for Britain. Hopefully Bill Etheridge at UKIP is going to be challenging this, but we've yet to see announcements from him. So you're not going to get it from the Tory party, because it looks like George Freeman, head of policy now at number 10 and head of the party, is going down this road. And we've got a clear message here. This is silence. This is consent via silence here. And she will refuse to debate it because she cannot, because the British people will not support surrendering our military and all that goes with them, in effect, to Germany via the EU. That is what we're talking about.
OK, well, another thing we published on the website this morning was your evidence to the Defence Committee on EU Military Union. Give us some background to this request for comment from the Defence Committee, and tell us a little about what you've said here.
Well, the article I'm seeing here is budgetary union.
That's evidence to the Defence Committee on EU Military Union.
Okay, so you use the same banner. Okay, yeah. What we're talking about here is actually the coalface stuff here is actually where the money's going to be spent. And that's huge amounts of money involved initially with the procurement. And this is the big political lever. And what we're saying to Defence Committee is that essentially all of the policy gearing as it stands at the moment has been for some 60 or 70 years since the 50s, 60s, and it's ingressed and it's subverted the whole industrial procurement policy, money flows, the political levers that people see, you know, whether their families involved with the armed services or engineering or whatever. That's that the coalface end of it. And what we're saying is all of that at the moment, by deed or effect, whether they know it or not, has been EU-directed. It is solely geared at the moment to be going down an EU military union road. It has to, because that was the original concept and plan. We know this from Avril Harriman. So this is not news to us, but it's news to the MPs because they just are not aware of it. Now, I can confirm that because of the interface I've had personally and with the other groups that have formed to try and challenge this, like Veterans for Britain, are telling me the same thing, that they talk to MPs and they have no idea about it. It is completely off their radar. So we've got a massive challenge here in order to combat this. And what we're saying is we can actually have an effective Brexit, but we need to have control of our own budget and our own procurement and our own industry and be feeding that money into the UK. Because as it stands at the moment, all of that money is being redistributed, which is a master European policy. Redistribution of wealth, redistribution of people, and particularly redistribution of defence. Now, that goes hand in glove with the currency. So you can see by the original recipe that we're aware of now that the key factors here to get to full political union are, one, a united currency, a currency union; two, military union. That triggers the Treasury, then they can have full political union, which, as we know, is a tyranny. So people have got to understand, the MPs have got to be made to understand that the military union thing is vital. So when we were told for 10 or 20 years now that there are no votes in defence, what they really meant was, for Christ's sake, we can't tell the British people what's going on here because they'll never vote for it, because there are no votes in EU, us being in EU defence. That's what it is.
So what were the circumstances that this request for comment came about?
Well, it was jointly Alex Thompson and I sort of worked on it. And all credit to Alex on this, because he's been very pivotal in doing it with us. My triggering for this was Sandy Woodward's attempt in 2010 to challenge it at Defence Committee. And I've kind of picked up the pieces from that. And the problem we saw instantaneously is Sandy and Julian Thompson, who's now chair of Veterans for Britain, were approaching this from the perspective as UK as a nation state. And their argument was that we needed our own defence and to stop the cutting on that basis. Now, of course, the problem they had, and they may not have been aware, is that the EU, this thing, whatever it is called, the EU, does not recognise nation states. So it was a dead duck. It was never going to, it was challenging something that frankly didn't recognize that Britain would be a nation state. So their argument didn't go anywhere. And we've carried on cutting under Sir Gerald Howarth at the 2010 review. And he then subsequently got a knighthood from it. And we're carrying on cutting. We're seeing our basically the UK assets being sold short, a shortening of the position, and it's being trimmed in order for it to be acceptable blend and merge rates with Germany. That's the bottom line. Germany would not allow us to join with the quantity of forces that we had in the 60s and 70s. It was too big. They probably feared that it wasn't going to work because of the money flows, and there was always the danger that we would turn on them in the future if we had greater forces. So this is obviously the bottom line here. So that was our whole basis of challenging this was from that perspective, from Admiral Woodward, who I consider to be an utterly loyal and heroic admiral, with the guts and balls that we sort of saw with Sir John Fieldhouse and Henry Leach in 1982 when they knocked on Maggie's door, forced their way in and said, you're not selling those through-deck cruisers, the anti-submarine aircraft carriers, as they're sort of known colloquially, to Australia. And then we subsequently had the Falklands War. But as I said at the British Constitution Group conference, the rot had already begun because instantly they cut all that stuff and all the key stuff that we had that would have given us long reach under our own weapon systems and paddling our own canoe, were all cut instantaneously. And this goes hand in glove with master European policy.
David, thank you very much for that. What I'm going to do very, very shortly is take us through a few of the key issues around defence at the moment to try and explain to people some of the background to statements being made by Michael Fallon, for example. But of course, one of the things we know is that commercial interests have got deeper and deeper into our procurement system. So instead of the military going through government to buy equipment from private companies, we've now got the private companies thoroughly embedded into the military procurement system. Indeed, many would say that they're running it. And what we can show is, of course, that these companies are not necessarily to be trusted. So we're just going to have a look at Rolls-Royce, and then we'll jump back to who's saying what about the defence, the state of defence.
So, David, we mentioned this yesterday. I just wanted to get some comments from you about it. But just to remind everybody, this is Rolls-Royce paying penalties of £670 million plus interest and cost to avoid prosecution over corruption allegations. And this is the largest deferred prosecution agreement, which has been approved by the English courts. And something that I didn't mention yesterday, it was Sir Brian Leveson of the Leveson Inquiry. He's currently president of the Queen's Bench Division, who approved that decision. So the deal, £497 million goes to the UK Serious Fraud Office, $169 million, which is £140 million. Goes to the Department of Justice, and $25 million goes to Brazil. So I don't know whether how aware you are of this, but the point I made yesterday, David, was that, of course, the Serious Fraud Office, they've been pushing these deferred prosecution agreements. They call them a key weapon in their anti-corruption armoury, and they've been pushing them since David Green became head of the Serious Fraud Office in 2012. The point I made yesterday was that Serious Fraud Office in these types of inquiries, and I mentioned the Al Yamama Arms deal, BAE in Saudi Arabia, where they lost the evidence. And of course, Tony Blair had direct impact in having that investigation dropped. These deferred prosecution agreements allow them to sort of get something out of it without political interference. But of course, no prosecutions are ever brought.
No, I mean, it's all inverted, isn't it? I mean, we've got a key engineering manufacturing driver here like Rolls-Royce, so it's proper tier one, top of the family tree here in the UK, and as it is in the US and to an extent in Europe. So what I see here really is that Rolls-Royce's stock is in play. It's as simple as that. And we're going to see more shenanigans. I think when you overlap the current sort of topography there, they've had a layoff of some 2,000 engineers recently. They've selling a huge amount of equipment into Iran, enough to actually build engines in Iran via spares. I understand that Rolls-Royce wanted the sanctions lifting against Russia so that they could begin trading again with Russia, because there were orders sitting, begging, waiting there. So you can see here really that,
when you look at the bigger picture, and particularly with what we're going to see now with the acceleration of EU military union under the cover of Brexit, that this spending that's going to be announced soon by the EU, we're going to go on a round robin with mergers and acquisitions with these big companies like Rolls-Royce and BAE. We're going to see some huge movement there, and this is part of that movement.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for that, David. Well, I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes going through what is being talked about as far as the British military is concerned at the moment. We'll bring you in for comments, but this is essentially a recap of the last few days. So we're going to focus straight away with the first Sea Lord. Here he is, Philip Jones. And as we said yesterday, this man appears surprised that the Russians, contrary to what's been going on through the Ministry of Defence and the Royal Navy, the Russians have not been standing still. They've now come out with some very good equipment. But apparently all of this has caught the Royal Navy by surprise. We just didn't realise that the Russians were doing this. And one of the things that the press in particular are trying to say at the moment is that we're in some sort of change situation. Well, we're absolutely not. If we have a look at a picture, I've labelled this Cold War or 2017. There's no change. What we've got is that basically the Russians want to bring their nuclear bombers, that's the ballistic missile systems, submarines out into the Atlantic. They're bringing Hunter killer nuclear submarines out with them in order to protect them. And the key area is what's called the Iceland-Faroes Gap or the Denmark Strait, because this is a sort of choke point as the submarines move into the Atlantic. Now, why do they want to move into the Atlantic? Because be under no illusion, if there was to be conflict in Europe, Europe would still be dependent on American supplies, munitions, food, equipment coming across the Atlantic. And the Russians are going to obviously try and stop that. But also in peacetime, the Russians are moving these submarines out in order to get their ballistic missile submarines in positions where they can launch their missiles. And if we take the submarines indicated off the American east coast there, of course, the Russians want to bring submarines in close to the American coast because it reduces warning time. This is exactly why the Russians are being put under huge pressure by NATO moving missile systems right up onto the Russian border. But in the middle of this, we're trying to hide Britain's own ballistic nuclear submarine. So this is a game of cat and mouse. But nothing has changed except the fact that the Royal Navy and the Ministry of Defence suddenly appear shocked that Russia has continue to develop excellent equipment and is deploying it. So I think we must be seeing negligence on behalf of either the British intelligence services or the MOD in that we're getting to this state. And this is the state that the Navy is hiding behind a smokescreen of half-truths. We talked about this, some of this yesterday, but it says that NATO is on the verge of a new battle of Atlantic. With increasingly sophisticated Russian submarines. I'm going to highlight this, the decision to scrap the Nimrod maritime patrol aircraft, and I'll explain why this is so important, but also the whinge is there that the latest Type 45 destroyers have got major problems with engines, which our politicians are simply denying. And on it goes. So basically, they're saying that these nasty Russian submarines are trying to sniff out what Britain's nuclear deterrent is doing at Faz Lane. That was always true, so this is no news at all. This is old news. We've got this, a claim that it's not the missions, it's the information that they're after. This is complete and utter nonsense. I don't even know what it means. There's no substance in it. This is simply trying to ramp up the rhetoric against the Russians. And the Russians have been increasing their forces, and now we're suddenly surprised that other countries have been reducing. So, David, I'll just bring on this graph, and then I'll give you the chance to comment. This has come from Save the Royal Navy website. Interesting, we need a website saying Save the Royal Navy. Excellent material. Here is a really stunning graph showing the decline in the British fleet. On the left is the Cold War going back to the beginning of 1990, and then we're more or less coming up to date in 2012. And what do we see? An absolutely dramatic decrease in the size of Britain's Royal Navy, which nobody understands. It's all happened by accident. These ships have simply disappeared.
Absolutely. And Brian, it would take somebody skilled at sniffing submarines to assess the situation objectively. So I've got to commend you for that. And it dovetails perfectly with all the admirals that are whistleblowing to us on this and some chiefs of defence staff. So let's start from the big picture. OK, Cold War. A lot of people have submitted that it was over, and that is a nonsense. It was not over. It is never going to be over. All the while, nuclear weapons exist. The Cold War was derived from a threat to carpet bomb Russia with nuclear weapons. So all the while that the nuclear weapons exist, the Cold War will still carry on. Nothing has changed. Let's get that perfectly straight now. So anybody that says it was over in the 90s, utter nonsense. It was not. That was just literally some kind of spoof. So the only change at the moment is EU military union. That's the only thing on the table that's changing the topography of defense industry. There are no other factors. So the objectives within EU military union are specifically to stabilize the currency and allow the EU, whatever that is, whether it be Germany or another faction, to go into Ukraine and have a go. That seems to be my understanding of it. So those plans are accelerating. And what I'm seeing here is from Admiral Philip Jones is something being generated from a civil servant via the MOD. The Admiralty have not been allowed to speak out subsequent to, you know, after the Falklands War. They got very, very irritable in government that Admiral Henry Leach and Fieldhouse did what they did. They got very, very irritable with Admiral Sandy Woodward. And essentially over the last 20 years, the admirals have not been allowed to speak under a contractual obligation. So for this admiral to come out and speak is a contradiction to that existing policy. Now, I know that for a fact because I have spoke personally to Dr. Julian Lewis in Parliament several times about this issue face to face. Now, he's the chair of Defence Committee. So if anybody wants to challenge that, please come and do so. So this article here in The Telegraph, I do not believe it. He's got his photograph and his name on it, but I don't believe this is of substance. This is complete nonsense. So if the Admiralty want to come out and start talking about something, then let's have some objective comment. So I'm going to close loop here with reference to Admiral Boyce on what the big picture is. The EU wants nuclear weapons, and the only way it's going to get them is via France and Britain. So they've got to be corralled together, and then they can take control. So the corralling we've already seen under the Franco-British Council caper, and that joint venture will eventually lead to the EU obtaining its own nuclear weapons and command and control of those nuclear weapons. That is the bottom line. That is what all this is about. Now, the NATO situation at the moment is we've got to view NATO as a bus to EU military union. And the difficulties we've got there are, of course, is that as correctly strategically forecast quite some time ago, is that Trump had already made his position clear that he saw it as an obsolete organization. So too many people have hung their hat on that, not woke up and smelt the coffee, that cutting assisted the EU's endeavors. So if we want to do this properly, we've got to expand our military quickly and rapidly, expand our industry quickly and rapidly in order to offset EU military defense union. Because if we don't do that as a nation, we're going to be done for. If we continue to cut, we will fall into it by deed or effect, by negligence, or whether those people there think it's a good idea to manage it on this basis. But they need to accept the fact that what that will ultimately mean is that the EU will be a nuclear power.
David, thank you very much for that. I'm just going to bring in a couple of images to support what you've been talking about. Firstly here, this is the madness that's going on. Next year, we get rid of our anti-ship missile, the Harpoon, American missile system, very good missile system. That's going to simply be taken off British warships, leaving them without any major anti-ship missile system. The comment here from Save the Navy is this state of affairs is unacceptable, dangerous, and risks making the Navy a laughingstock. It doesn't risk, it is making the Navy a laughingstock. We are going to be facing the Russian Navy with guns at a time when missile systems are an essential part of warfare. Now, let's bring in Mr. Fallon, because Mr. Fallon has been up visiting the bombers, the British nuclear deterrent boats, and he said this: around the clock, nuclear deterrent is as crucial to Britain's defence now as it's ever been. It's the ultimate guarantee of the nation's security. We use our nuclear deterrent every day to deter a nuclear attack, nuclear blackmail, and extreme threats that cannot be countered by any other means. But what happened back in 2011 is that the government scrapped the very aircraft that are essential to protecting Britain's nuclear deterrent. A 4 billion fleet of aircraft simply scrapped on the lie this was going to save £2 billion worth of money. So if we put this together, we've got Fallon saying how vital the nuclear deterrent is. We then need to scrap the Nimrods which defend those submarines. And the ultimate thing is we have now got a situation where our nuclear deterrent is unbelievably vulnerable to the Russians because we don't have this essential part of the defence. And to recap on your last point about the locking into the EU military, here it is, the Lancaster House agreements, Cameron signing the Defence and Security Cooperation Treaty with Sarkozy. But one of the key parts of it was this, that we were setting up through Aldermaston joint nuclear weapon facilities with the French. And this is the wedge in the door to hand our strategic nuclear deterrent to the French. That is what the EU has always required. And I'll finish off here very quickly so we can get Mark in. Let us remember what we showed yesterday, which is via an EU press document, we're seeing the map of the intended EU empire. Stretching right up to the borders of Russia and all around the Mediterranean rim, including, of course, the key Middle East countries. So this is an unbelievably dangerous situation. Theresa May and the Conservatives simply lying to the country about Brexit, while in the background we are being stripped of nuclear weapons and Britain's armed forces are being decimated so that we can be hoovered up by the EU.
Just before we move on, any just final comments on that, David?
Yeah, it's very clear. Fallon and May under Cameron and all the rest of them have cut the UK defence budgets, but they are increasing contributions to the EU Defence Agency. They're increasing their contributions to the EU Investment Bank, which funds the EU Defence Agency. And what we're seeing here basically is the table being laid up by Theresa May and Sir Mike Fallon to gift UK nuclear weapons to the EU via the French amalgamation. So it's just a game of leapfrog. So if the general public think giving nuclear weapons to the EU is a bad idea, they best start chirping up now.
Okay, thank you very much, David, for that. Okay, let's move on to Donald Trump then. And Mark, you're in Washington at the moment for the inauguration. But before we talk about that, you wanted to cover this article from the Truth Hound, your own website, Trump versus U.S. intelligence machine, a sparring match that Trump seems to be winning.
Yeah, our good friend in our news endeavor, Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire, this came from him. And I did a repost on my blog. The website is thetruthhound.com. And it correlates pretty much with what we've been discussing today. And it talks about, as the writer for Consortium News, Annie Machon writes here, or Macon, however you say her name. Apparently, she's formerly with British intelligence. but she writes that the clash between plutocratic President-elect Trump and the CIA is shaping up to be the heavyweight prize fight of the century. And Trump, at least to his credit, is approaching it with all the entertaining bombast of Muhammad Ali at the top of his game. And rather than following the tradition of doing dirty political deals in dark corners, Annie writes, more commonly known as fixing the match, Trump has come out instead swinging in the full glare of the media. So what's being reported by 21st Century Wire and then by my blog here in association is that Trump is taking on the intelligence agencies, of course, as we know, even before being sworn in as president this coming Friday at noon Eastern time on the west side of the Capitol. I'll be there for American Free Press. He's taking on the intelligence agencies beforehand, before he's even president, and he's doing, as this report shows, he's doing this in the open and trying to kind of smoke out all the layers of corruption brought about by the CIA long having too much power, long being able to sway the media and collude with the media, as a recently deceased German journalist wrote about. And so this is all coming out that the CIA needs to have its budget trimmed. It needs to have its endeavors reined in. And by association, the big media, the corporate media, where the real fake news comes from, they too need to be reined in. And if Trump is to be taken at his word, and we'll find out soon how sincere he really is about all his populist sentiments, if he's to be taken at his word, then we should be seeing some reining in of the runaway intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA, and also a reining in some fashion, or at least a depletion of the credibility of the big media. So this is a very pivotal time right now in terms of the presidency, intel, big media, and all these forces, which feeds into what your other guest is talking about today in many respects.
Mark, how much of Donald Trump's rhetoric do you think is for real, and how much of it is him just making fun of the media and the outrage of the political elites?
You know, that's a good question, Mike. It seems like it's coming down slanted a little bit toward it being real, but there are still questions, particularly the way those questions manifest themselves in his cabinet pick. On the one hand, he'll have a reasonably good cabinet pick like Jeff Sessions, an Alabama senator, to be the attorney general. And on the other hand, he'll have Mad Dog Mattis, this Marine general for Secretary of Defense, who seems to be a shoot first and ask questions later kind of guy. And that doesn't really bode well for pulling back on U.S. military interventionism. On the one hand, Trump seems to say, let's not police the world quite so much. But on the other hand, he's saying the Iran deal needs to be torn to shreds and that we need to always be there and have Israel's back. Israel being a aggressor nation, but wanting other nations to fight some of its dirtier, bloodier battles while it oppresses the Palestinians. So it's a tough call. We're sure going to know a lot more after Friday when he's actually president. But it is a mixed bag. And we do have to be careful, as you're implying, Mike, that some of this isn't just being bombastic and dramatic to placate some of the more populist sentiments in that part of the American people that want that. So it's a tough call. We're sorting it out through American Free Press and other means. We're sorting it out step by step, nominee by nominee, policy by policy. But there is a strong movement to get rid of Obamacare and replace it with the Republican plan on the domestic level. And a number of other things, and I'll be going back to Congress today on January 18th, this Wednesday, today that is, to see more of what they're saying and what they're doing to prepare for the Trump presidency.
Well, the question then, Mark, is will there be a Trump presidency? Because, the inauguration hasn't happened yet. Let's see what happens. So Patrick Henningsen here pointing out that Rosie O'Donnell tweeting out, and he's saying, you know, arguably irrelevant Hollywood personality, Rosie O'Donnell. But of course, people are reading these tweets and reacting accordingly. And so what did she have to say that he needed to, was it she said, I fully support imposing martial law, delaying the inauguration until Trump is cleared of all charges. And of course, this is the ridiculous and the discredited charges of Russian interference and so on. And then also from 21st Century Wire, highlighting advertisements seeking protesters against Trump, get paid fighting against Trump. And I mean, Putin himself made comment on this yesterday. He said, in my opinion, there are several goals. Well, he said he was talking about the, he was at a press conference talking about this. He said the impression is that after a practice run in Kiev, they're now ready to run a Maidan in Washington to prevent Trump from taking office. He said, in my opinion, there are several goals. Some are obvious. The first is to undermine the legitimacy of the elected president of the United States. Incidentally, in this connection, I would like to note that whether people who do it want it or not, they greatly damage U.S. interests. It seems that they trained for this in Kiev and are ready to organize a Maidan in Washington. The second goal is to tie the hands and legs of the newly elected president related to the implementation of his pre-election campaign's promises to the American people and the international community. These claims about the Russian interference are obviously fake. Trump, when he came to Moscow a few years ago, was not a politician. We did not even know about his political ambitions. He was just a businessman, one of the richest men in America. It's is someone really thinking that our intelligence agency are chasing every American billionaire? Of course not. It's just complete nonsense. And so on. He said, I don't know, Mr. Trump. I've never met him. I don't know what he'll do in the international arena. So I have no reason either to attack him, criticize him, or defend him. You know, there's a category of people who leave without saying good. Sorry. Then he went on to talk about Obama. And he said, you know, there's a category of people who leave without saying goodbye out of respect for the situation that has evolved so as not to upset anyone. And then there are people who keep saying goodbye but don't leave. I believe the outgoing administration belongs to the second category. And that, so the question is, Mark, is the inauguration going to happen successfully, or is it going to be utterly disrupted by agent provocateur hired for the job?
Said if Trump weren't for real. So that's some indication that Trump is seen as a real populist menace to the usual conservative liberal dichotomy that we're given here that always puts us down the primrose path, the wrong path. It does give a little more credence to Trump's credibility. Therefore, Trump would be presumably in a little more danger if he's for real about all this populist, nationalist, anti-New World Order ideas. So By the same token, they talk very proudly in America. You hear it all the time in Congress. I did just yesterday that one of the great things about America is we always have a peaceful transition of power. There's never something like what happened in Kiev. It's always democratic, respectable, honorable, peaceful. And America prides itself on the lack of revolution to put a new leader in. So I really don't think that they'll actually literally block Trump from being sworn in, unless something akin to Dallas in 63 were to happen. And of course, you know, perish the thought. That's a terrible thought. Of course, America has that precedent. It has that in its history, plus James Garfield, plus William McKinley, not just Abraham Lincoln, not just JFK. But all things considered, I think we're going to see Trump sworn in as president. The real question being, will he really live up to his promises with all the neocon pressure from the right, some of the pressure from the left? Of course, the country is basically owned by central bankers. Many nations are. He who creates the money really is the one that calls the shots. That's why governments need to take back their prerogative of creating money interest-free and not create it as debt. It all comes full circle. But it's going to be very interesting. I think Trump will be sworn in. The biggest threat they're making now is they're trying to close down Washington, these agitator groups that I'm sure are getting some Soros funding, create havoc on the metro train, create havoc on the main thoroughfares, block a lot of the main roads. I myself am going to walk from my hotel to the west side of the Capitol for the inauguration. I don't even want to get on the metro. And so I think it's more bluff than reality that they're going to shut down Washington and prevent Trump from being sworn in. They're bringing in some National Guardsmen and some extra security. The security is ultra tight. But of course, I'll be there. If I learn something contrary, you'll be the first to hear about it, and we'll see what happens. I hate to make too many predictions. It gets risky.
Yes, indeed. Okay, Mark, I'd like to get a little bit of comment Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, whatever she is, his sentence has been commuted by Obama on his way out. Of course, the usual suspects like John McCain are pretty unhappy about that. They're describing it as a grave mistake, that it's going to encourage further acts of espionage and undermine military discipline. It's going to devalue the courage of real whistleblowers. Chelsea Manning being released on the May the 17th, I believe. And also Edward Snowden has been given another lifeline because Maria Zakharova has announced today that his residence permit in Russia has been extended for another couple of years. So what do you make about Chelsea Manning first?
Well, clearly President Obama wanted to make some deep brownie points as he's leaving the White House and clinging to every last piece of furniture. He really doesn't want to leave. He's grown accustomed to this posh lifestyle. Nevertheless, as he's getting ready to go, I will say that I basically think it's a good thing. I think President Obama's doing it to placate people, to leave a better legacy for himself. And it will create a better situation, briefly speaking, I hope it does at least, for not only Edward Snowden, but Julian Assange. There's a statue in the United Nations plaza area in Geneva, Switzerland, where you have Snowden, Manning, and Julian Assange on three chairs. And then there's an empty chair, and that's supposed to symbolize the rest of people, the rest of humanity, all seeking freedom through these people that are all claim to be, you know, the great friends of liberty that have exposed all these things going on in government. And we could all hope that they're all for real. You know, there are allegations that Julian Assange isn't quite what he's cracked up to be, things that are a little hard to verify. But taking it at face value, I think, despite Obama's self-serving approach here, the situation with Mr. or Mrs. Manning, whatever you want to call him or her, is largely a good thing.
Okay, and look, we're just going to end on this one, Mark. You wanted to mention Udo Ulfkotte, the German journalist who passed away.
Yes, I think this is important in that quite some time ago, Udo had the guts, the nads, some of us say, to talk about the direct collusion between intelligence and media. And this underscores what we and I have been saying all along. I'm working on a book called Weaponized Media. There's my cheap plug. But this really shows very tangibly, and going back quite some time, how the CIA works with media. And that would explain why there's so much distortion on what's really going on with the actual liberation of Aleppo in Syria, why you don't hear about it. As Udo explained before his reported passing, January 14, right around that time, he supposedly died of heart failure at age 56. This explains, as he explained, that the media and the intelligence agencies approach reporters and use them as unofficial deniable assets. They get them through enticements, perhaps bribery, other enticements, who knows, maybe even threats at times, to report the foreign policy narratives and intel narratatives that the CIA or MI6 or Mossad want, primarily CIA, according to Udo. And the reporters get posh assignments working for think tanks and these global research institutes that we talk about on this show. But then they're a deniable asset. If the reporters found out, the CIA will not own up to ever having any contact or collusion with that reporter. So according to Udo, who's left us with a useful legacy, he's gone the extra mile here from what I understand. You know, this collusion has been going on a long time. The reporters are deniable assets. This is how it works. And this goes a long way in explaining why we don't hear about the liberation of Aleppo, why we don't get reality about what happened in Ukraine, why Russia really went into Crimea, why all of that is so distorted, because these reporters are enticed to follow the foreign policy narratives of the major Western powers. And Udo apparently was among the few, and was perhaps the best among the few, to expose how and why that happens. So I thought that was important to recognize this in the, only 4 or 5 days since his passing.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much for that. And we look forward to your book. Hopefully UK column will get a positive mention in that. Extremely interesting. You probably didn't catch our reports yesterday on the fact that we can now show that BBC has simply been helping to run European media. Instead of it just being biased and supporting the European Union, we're able to show that its proxy charity was actually putting together the whole of the media document, telling journalists, particularly in new members to the EU and former Soviet states, how they could get data which was positive to the EU and how they could get that message across. So the BBC now totally exposed as part of the European Union project. We're delighted to give you some more information for your book on that one. And David, we'll just say to you, thank you very much for your analysis. We're now seeing the danger still of the European Union. But everybody should remember, of course, much of the great lies being told to the public at the moment stem from the fact that we're to believe there's a shortage of money. But nobody in the British government at the moment wants to talk about the Bradbury pound. And local MP Dr. Sarah Wollaston has sent a one-line reply saying she doesn't want to talk about the mechanism of a reissuing of Bradbury pound national currency in order to solve these problems. So we've got a lot of work to do.
UK column meeting tonight.
Indeed.
And also tonight, 7:30 on the live stream, we'll be playing the latest episode of Fracking Nightmare, which is delayed from Monday because they had a power failure up at the camp.
We need those Chinese power stations,
we
Mike.
Do. Yes.
Yeah. David, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.